Let the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources come to order on this 13th?
14th.
Day of March? 14th? On this 14th day of March. We're going to start, committee members, with Senator Sharon, Senate File 142. Senator Sharon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to present Senate File 142. This is an amendment to, and I have a copy of the sort of statute because it's not afforded for you.
Sure.
To the statute relating to gammon fish exempting remote controlled animal noise callers from the general prohibition on using radios to take game animals. It amends Minnesota statute section 97B.085. During the campaign, or just after the election, I met with a constituent of mine who brought this to my attention that this one-way radio device, a calling system, has some question about whether or not it is allowable and certainly work within the spirit of the law in relationship to game and fish. And so he asked that an amendment be made to make it very clear that this was an allowable device. So with that introduction, I would, with your permission, Mr. Chair, like to introduce you to Mr. Gary Peters, who would like to speak to this request and to the committee.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Gary Peters.
Go ahead.
I'm here to represent a group of Minnesota sportsmen that are known as predator callers. We use various animal calls generated from either mouth calls or electronic callers that mimic the sounds of prey animals in distress in order to hunt predatory animals such as fox and coyotes. The various sounds are of birds in distress, deer in distress, as well as rabbits in distress. These sounds have been used for centuries to attract various predatory animals such as foxes, coyotes, and bobcats, and the use of these sounds, mouth calls, and electronic callers is currently a legal form of hunting in Minnesota. Recent advances in electronics and radio technology have allowed the development of reasonably priced, remote-controlled electronic animal callers, and these products are being offered for sale to citizens of Minnesota in most major sporting goods stores. These remote control callers use a one-way radio frequency to control the various functions of the caller, such as turning it off and on, controlling the volume, and changing the sounds from a remote distance. They work just like your key fob on your car keychain. Unfortunately, the written language of Minnesota state law, statute 97B.085, makes the use of any radio equipment to take any game animal illegal in the state. However, the Minnesota DNR freely issues permits for the use of radio equipment, such as two-way walkie-talkies, or as well as cell phones, to take unprotected animals such as coyotes. I myself applied for and received one this past fall and now can legally use my remote control caller for hunting coyotes only. Our small group of Minnesota sportsmen have asked Senator Sharon to help us change this law by making the use of these remote controlled callers legal for the taking of game animals, since the use of electronic calls is already legal to use in our state. By amending the current law, legislature will allow us to use these remote control callers to take game animals while maintaining the spirit of fair chase by keeping the use of two-way radios illegal. I encourage the members of this committee to support this basic and common sense bill. We brought along some callers, some of the devices for to demonstrate. Would you like me to demonstrate them?
Mm-hmm.
This call.
Okay. I'm not going to be feel the urge to come toward the table or anything, am I?
I'll stop you.
Not if you're.
This call will you. This call is can be used with. It's perfectly legal to use this call right now without the remote control. Okay. The remote control is a small radio one-way communicator.
But with a permit. Or without,
I can use this right now without a permit to shoot any animal in the state of Minnesota, any game animal.
Okay. Go ahead.
To use the permit, I have to get a DNR permit, and I can only shoot coyotes with it.
Okay.
Unprotected animals.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the range? So you could set this thing down off to the side, and you can actually be hidden in a blind someplace in remote control.
Yes.
Get a better idea for that.
Depending on the terrain, 100, 200, 300 yards, depending on whether it's elevated or on the ground.
Got it.
Mr. Peters, go ahead and give us a demonstration.
It's electronic. I hope it works. That's a rabbit in distress. I can mute it. I can turn it back on. Turn the volume up. Or I can change the call. Various animals of prey in distress. It's a dinner bell for a coyote.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
And it saves the rabbit. Because there's no rabbit there, right?
There's no rabbit there.
Saves the rabbit, right?
Other questions for Mr. Peters? Thank you.
Thanks.
Is there, Senator Sharon, do you have anyone else that would like to testify?
I know
for
that,
or against? Yes.
I don't have anybody for or against. Mr. Meyer from the DNR, if he was here, was going to speak to the fact that this had been reviewed with them.
Did Mr. Bogus care to take his spot at the table? Mr. Bogus, welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR, we're fine with this. It's more of a technicality with an old law relating to use of radios, which I'm sure at the time it was passed dealt with two-way radios, but it does include all radio equipment. There was previously an exemption a number of years ago for use of collars on dogs that utilize radios, and so this is another specific exemption that we're okay with.
Any questions for Mr. Bogus? I will just, for the record, the committee should see that there is a letter that has been sent around from the Humane Society of the United States opposing this legislation, and they wanted that entered into the record. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for whoever. How many predator collars do we have in the state of Minnesota, approximately?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, we do an estimate of how many coyote hunters, how many fox hunters, raccoon hunters, but I can't recall that number off the top of my head. I know we've got about 7,000 trappers in the state. I'm guessing the number of predator hunters is probably out of the 270,000 small game hunters in the state. It's maybe 10% of those or less.
Other questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my apologies to Senator Sharon if she's already responded to this, but how would you respond? Have you had a chance to read the Humane Society letter?
I just received it here.
Right. Well, the Humane Society believes that this violates the fair hunt principle. So I'm wondering how you would respond to that critique.
Mr. Peters. Jeez.
These devices are already legal. The use of the remote is legal under permit for hunting coyotes. The DNR will give you one, no questions asked.
But, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is not confined. Up. Is this confined to coyotes?
Under permit only.
Right.
If a red fox or a gray fox comes running to the call, I legally cannot shoot the animal if I'm using the remote control.
Okay.
That's under current law.
And that's under current law, Mr. Peters.
Yes.
What you're suggesting is that we take that provision out.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I obviously missed something significant then. Does this statute only concern the taking of coyotes, this change?
No, it concerns making the remote control legal to use.
For
harvesting game animals.
Okay, so it's not confined to just coyotes.
That's correct.
Okay. So I guess I return to my previous question. Coyotes notwithstanding, everyone doesn't like them. Everyone seems to think we should be able to shoot as many of them as possible. I don't necessarily think that, but people do. It's the fairness and sportsmanship and hunting critique of the Humane Society is the critique in general hunting for regular game.
I think I'd like to defer again to Mr. Peters, but I think what was said in earlier testimony is that the unfair hunting practices are, the concern is around two-way calling devices. This is a remote control device. It's not a two or cellular phones. And anything that has a two-way frequency would create and constitute an unfair hunting situation. This is seen as simply because it's, you could have this now without the remote and put it out without the remote and then have to walk back up, adjust it, and play it again. You can already do this kind of calling. This is the issue, the remote piece.
I see. Thank
Senator
you.
Olson, did you have a question?
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Chairman, what other, just refresh my memory as to if it's allowable for coyote, which is a predatory animal, but there are other predatory animals that are game animals. So is it only the fox that is added to the ones that this is used for, or what other game animals are involved? Maybe you or Mr. Bogus could.
Mr. Peters?
I use this in the spring conservation order for hunting snow geese. You can use electronic callers. The federal government allows us to use them. The province of Manitoba and Saskatchewan allows us to use these in the fall hunting season for white geese, or light geese they're called. The remote controls are allowed up there as well. So there's governments that allow us to use it, and the federal law allows us to use these during the spring hunting season for snow geese. It's a conservation order, though. In the United States, we cannot use these for migratory animals. There's already laws on the books for that. But we can call. I've called in hawks and owls with this. They're not game animals. We don't hunt them. But these, you can have deer calls on here, like a deer bleat, a fawn bleat to attract deer. I don't personally use it for that. I use it for predator hunting, predator animals.
Mr. Bogus, did you want to add anything to that, or?
Mr. Chair, that was pretty much what I was going to say. There is a federal restriction against using electronic calls for migratory birds, with the exception of when you're outside the hunting seasons and doing it for a management action like the spring light goose hunting. And there's also a state rule against using electronic calls for wild turkeys. But other than that, any game species, you could use this call. You can use these calls for right now, and the issue is the use of radio equipment to control the caller. You can use a wire. You can walk up to it and switch it on or off. But as soon as you start using radio equipment to control it, that's what this bill is addressing.
I think just for clarification, the use of the device is already in law. We're talking about whether or not we can use the remote without a permit.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Sharon, would you like to?
I would like to make a motion to
recommend this to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Thank you very much.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Going back to the top of the page, or?
Yeah.
Senate File 1156 would be Senator Coring's bill. Not here?
Senator Saxog.
Oh, Senator Saxog will be coming to the table. Okay. Senator Saxog, I believe you're speaking for others today. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am presenting Senate File 1156 for Senator Coring today because I'm co-author on the bill. This is a standard request for Crow Wing County. We've handled it other years. It's to do private sales of two parcels of tax-forfeited land. The DNR and Crow Wing County support this legislation, and with me today is Kathy Lewis of the DNR Lands and Minerals Department and Tom Cowell, Crow Wing County Commissioner.
Fine.
Maybe you...
come to the table, please.
Come to the table and say a few words.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thomas Cowell, Crow Wing County Land Commissioner.
And?
I'm Kathy Lewis with Lands and Minerals Division, DNR.
Who would like to begin? Mr. Cowell?
Well, I would just say that the there are two tracts. One is in the city of 50 Lakes in the northern part of the county. The other is in the city of Crosby. Both cities, Crosby and City of 50 Lakes, support this. Crow Wing County Board of Commissioners supports it. The DNR supports it. And these tracts, they don't fit into our management strategies, and it makes sense to liquidate these tracts.
Questions for Mr. Cowell. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are any of these lands school trust fund lands? Or?
No. They are tax-forfeited lands. Which are state-deeded lands. They are held by the state in trust for the local taxing districts.
Okay. Yeah.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, we've had these bills before here over the years I've been here. I've been looking at this. Is any attempt made to an owner that resides up there would have a chance to bid on it, or is this kind of has to go to the city of Crosby? We've always give somebody a chance at least to bid on the property, and I don't know if that's standard.
Senator Vickerman, if I could add to that question, just I guess the two words private sale seem to be a little... That's kind of what you're getting at,
yes,
I believe, the private sale aspect of it?
I'm saying I want constituents at least to have a fair chance if somebody. And second thing, I'd like to put a rider on here that you can't build townhouses on it. And mm-hmm. If you turn it over, they can do anything they want with it.
I believe you're right, Senator Vickerman. But
if Mr. Chair?
Maybe I just have an answer.
Senator Saxog.
Well, before we let the two experts answer, I guess I'd just say that any tax forfeit land transfer that borders public water requires legislation. No, it's just a given.
Well, Senator Saxog, I'm not arguing that point. My point is
Senator Vickerman.
Constituents that maybe, I don't know where this is, maybe some guy lives right there and like to have a chance at least to bid on the property. Maybe I'm not following it that well.
Mr. Call.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vickerman, the tract in the city of 50 Lakes would be the private sale. The Minnesota statute does allow for a private sale to an adjacent owner of a non-conforming tract, and that's what this piece of property is. The other tract would be a sale to the city of Crosby. They have an interest in expanding their maintenance facilities on this piece of property and also the consideration of a water well. Again, Minnesota statute does allow for a direct sale to a governmental subdivision for a public purpose.
And Senator Vickerman, we're having Mr. Knopf look that up right now. Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I saw that it was being sold to the city of Crosby. I was trying to find where the private... So there's two different parcels here, mm-hmm. and one can be sold to an adjacent property owner? And that's... So it's limited to that, but it's done by private sale.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that is correct.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you have a question?
No, just a point of clarification. The other tract of land can be by statute sold to the city and not offered to public.
That is correct.
Ms. Lewis, did you want to weigh in at this point?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The DNR has reviewed both parcels and has no objection. I would note on the first parcel that there's going to be a conservation easement placed on the land before it is sold. And so that conservation easement will be held by the Department of Natural Resources, and there will be restrictions on the development of that parcel.
Does that answer your question, Senator Vickerman?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm sure it answers the Chair's conservation plan. That's my concern.
Mr. Knopf, do you have...
Mr. Chairman, just one issue with this is many times if it's a non-conforming lot and we're doing a public or a private sale, there is a provision that the witness talked about. It's Section 282.01, Subdivision 7A, which allows for sales to adjoining landowners when the land can't be used for anything else. And you could put a provision in there that says by private sale under Minnesota statutes, Section 282.01, Subdivision 7A, so it's basically it has to be to an adjoining landowner at that point, since this is a developable by itself. And I think that's the intent, and it does clarify in the law what's going on here.
Would you be more comfortable with that?
Well,
I would.
Senator Vickerman? That's right. You don't get to be comfortable, do you, Mr. Knopf? Senator Saxog, would you believe that Senator Coring would be all right with adding that?
Well, I would think so, Mr. Chair. Is that okay with you, Ms. Lewis? And the two parties are in agreement with that, so we could. Is Senator Vickerman going to make that motion?
Senator Vickerman will make the oral amendment.
And Mr. Chairman, it would be on line 1.9 after sale. Include comma under Minnesota statutes, comma section 282.01, comma subdivision 7A, comma.
I'll move that amendment.
The amendments before us is read by Mr. Knopf and motion made by Senator Vickerman. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Senator Saxon, would you like to move the bill as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd move that we lay Senate File 1156 as amended over for inclusion in Senate File 1119.
A follow-up question, Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just have been trying. Obviously, my education hasn't been complete, but beginning at page 2, line 18, and on, with all of these degrees and minutes and seconds, is this trying to track a varied boundaries, or how, you know, it seems all over the place. What is this describing in a general way?
Mr. Call.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that legal description was developed by the Crow Wing County Surveyor, and what they did was walked on the ice along the south side of the pit and took GPS points as they walked along. And they used that to develop the legal description.
Along the pit, you said?
This is a mine pit in Crosby.
Okay.
Is that a common practice?
Commonly referred to as a pit lake.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have the motion before us again. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you for your time. Senator Saxog, am I to understand you're also taking up Senate File 1401?
I am, Mr. Chair. And I'm presenting Senate
What do you get for your services, Senator?
Well, in this particular case, I'll be in the good graces of Senator Perezzo. And she's busy getting things ready for the Ducks Unlimited banquet tonight that many of us will be attending. So this is another standard request. It's to transfer parcel land in Ravenna Township and the DNR... Dakota County and Ravenna Town Board all support this provision. And with me today is Kathy Lewis from the DNR Minerals Department, who you heard from previously, and County Commissioner Joe Harris, Dakota County.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourselves.
I'm Dakota County Commissioner Joe Harris.
I'm Kathy Lewis of the DNR.
Thank you. Go ahead, Senator. Anything to add to that brief description? Or should we hear from Mr. Harris? Yep.
Yeah, I would turn this over to Mr. Harris for a few comments.
Mr. Harris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a piece of property that is basically flood-prone. That's the reason why it has went tax forfeiture. And the Ravana Town Board has a township road next to it, and they are very interested in receiving this piece of property from the tax under tax forfeiture rule and to utilize it for flood control measures in this particular area. It's basically a dry wash, and it at times it can have anywhere from 2 to 3 feet of water in it after heavy rainfalls. And it creates serious problems for their town road, and they want to do some major culverting, if that's even a word. It was hard to say, but as it pertains to the flooding of their town road in that particular area. So,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm reading this right on the first page. Line 113 to line 114, subject to restrictions imposed by the Commissioner of Natural Resources, so they can't go in there and just do a little bit of everything. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Harris, you understand that there are some restrictions, or the DNR will be watching?
Necessary permits will have to be received from the DNR as well as Dakota County as a shoreland and floodplain ordinance keeper in Dakota County. So.
Any other questions? Ms. Lewis, anything to add?
Mr. Chair, the DNR has reviewed this bill, and we have no objections to it.
Senator Saxon, would you like to move this bill?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we lay Senate File 1401 over for inclusion in Senate File 1119.
To the motion, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Saxog, Senate File 1119.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a subcommittee report that we need to approve, and I have a the A3 amendment to go on to that. I suppose I would believe that we need to approve the subcommittee report first.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move adoption of the subcommittee report.
Senator Frederick moves that we adopt the subcommittee report. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would like to propose the A3 amendment to the subcommittee report.
It's coming around the committee. We'll take a quick look at it. Senator Saxog, I believe we all have our amendment in front of us.
It's a relatively simple amendment, Mr. Chair. We didn't catch it earlier, but after land, we need to put bordering public water.
Okay, just a second. We're looking. Does everybody have the papers they need?
And as I said earlier, Mr. Chair, it's the reason why we have to bring them in the first place is because they are bordering public water.
Mr. Knopf doesn't have a copy of the bill, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think anyone has a copy of the bill. I think that the subcommittee reports sometimes are delete everything amendments. This time it's not. This is an add-on to the existing, so you don't have the language from the original bill in front of you. And they are getting copies now.
Senator Saxog, I'd like to lay this over while they Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this amendment is to the subcommittee report.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the only issue is to finally act on this bill. You don't have the rest of the language in front of you that they'll be describing.
Okay, thanks.
Can I lay it aside till we get that in the building here, and then we'll come back to you?
Thank you.
We have one left, Mr. Chair, if you wanted to. Okay. Senate file 1174. Senator Sieben. Do they have that? Okay. We have a handout or pass out coming around.
No, you just need to have the original bill. Because that's an amendment to the original bill. So all you need is the original bill.
Senator, would you like to wait till everybody has their paperwork? Or?
I would prefer that.
Okay,
probably
we'll
make more sense.
We'll sit tight for a second. Committee, you're looking at Senate File 1174. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm very pleased to be here today to tell you that at this point, I don't feel it's necessary to advance Senate File 1174, and I'm withdrawing it from consideration before the committee at this time. And if I can indulge you for a minute, I'll just explain the reason why. Late yesterday afternoon, I received letters from the commissioner of the PCA that outlined that a good portion of what Senate File 1174 hoped to accomplish was going to be undertaken by the Pollution Control Agency. So at this point, I would like to publicly thank the PCA for their work on this issue and their plan to designate PFOA and PFOS as substances that should be covered under MRLA, the Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act. By way of background, 3M company produced PFCs in its Cottage Grove plant and then released them into the air, groundwater, and Mississippi River over many decades. Increased public attention in the news media has focused on the contamination of PFCs in drinking water in a number of the communities in Washington County. Senate File 1174 was a bill, or my attempt, to look out for the citizens of Minnesota and to ensure that the public would not be left paying costs associated with remediation of the PFC pollution. Again, I think it's been distributed yesterday, but the letter from the Pollution Control Agency was delivered to my office that outlines that the MPCA does indeed consider PFOA and PFOS to be hazardous substances under MRLA. While the agency needs to formally have this approved by their citizens board, the commissioner has assured me that he and his agency support classifying PFOA and PFOS under MRLA. And I believe that you've also been passed out. A letter from the Attorney General has also been distributed on this subject. So with that, I'd just like to ask someone from the PCA to briefly explain background on their intent, on their action and the intent of the letters that have been distributed to you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Schirkenbach. I am the Assistant Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, responsible for land programs, which includes our remediation programs, our hazardous waste programs, emergency response, and programs related to those. And again, what I wanted to do is just say the purpose of the letters that went out yesterday was to just indicate and make clear to 3M our intent to more formalize the arrangement under the Superfund program, which is MRLA, and by declaring a PFOS, PFOS hazardous substance, that's one of the conditions under which you need to do in order to get to that point. And
Mr. Schirkenbach,
yes,
some of the
the issues and background are not totally familiar to the members, particularly some of the terminology.
Okay.
So if there is an acronym that you could perhaps just completely explain, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, sorry for that. Maybe it's best, there are a variety of different perfluorochemicals, and the PFOA and PFOS are just two of those types that are parts of eight-chain carbon elements that are part of what was used in Scotchgard materials, and it was produced at 3M. So these are the two we've been focusing on, because those have been the two that we found in that have been disposed of in three sites out in the eastern communities, basically at the Chemolite facility, at the Oakdale landfill, and at also at a Woodbury dump site. And so these have been the ones we've been focusing on, because those are the ones that we've found in the groundwater and have received health-based values from the health department indicating that they believe there is a health risk associated with these. And so those have been the ones. Now, what's confusing is you probably also heard something PFBA, which is a four-chain element and under this overall class of perfluorochemicals. And that's one where right now there has not been a determination by health department as far as the health-based value being used. It gives us what the basis we need to say that there's an imminent and substantial health risk involved with those. And they are working on that. But there will be some period of time. They have given us the estimate of maybe by the end of the year, early of 2008, we would have that. That would then allow us also to be looking at that as a possibly a hazardous substance, depending upon what values they come up with for dealing with that. So what we have been doing is, first of all, I want to indicate 3M has been moving ahead with the agency on investigation and remedial action out at these three sites and a number of other related issues. But what we felt is, for three reasons, we felt it was important to basically get to this point at this time. One is, but recently the health department came up and in a press release announced that they were lowering the health-based values for these two particular perfluorochemicals, PFOS and PFOA. So with that lowering, we felt it was critical that we get and maybe make a formal determination and get it under MRLA, which is the state statute that deals with cleanups. Secondly, we were aware, and as the senator is very aware and other representatives and senators in the area, there's extreme concern, and rightfully so, of people in the area about what's happening. And we wanted to make sure that they understood that we're using all the formal tools that we have in order to address this. And third, we're at the point with 3M where they are giving us some reports and coming in with recommendations on their best sense of what needs to be done for additional cleanup action at these sites. And we feel it's time then to take that and formalize it in the form of some type of either consent decree or other type of formal document that will provide certainty of what will happen and when it will happen at those sites.
What has led PCA to formalize this under this process under MRLA that it was didn't see the need before?
And again, Mr. Chair, good question. Again, I think we could have done this at other points in time. We felt there were so many issues that were up in the air as far as what needed to be done. And again, we knew that there may even be some differences happening at Health Department as far as their looks and the new information that was coming in with these two particular chemicals, that we just felt that it was appropriate to wait. But we just now have gotten to the point again where they have come up with these new revised health-based values. Again, given all the concern and the public meetings that have been held out in those communities and appreciating and hearing the public concern and the uncertainty and what's going to happen. And then third, given the fact that we're at a key point where we are going to be getting in information from 3M on these three sites that we believe will lead to a selection of final cleanup remedies or cleanup remedies, and therefore it was appropriate to make sure that we get these in formal agreements so everybody can understand again that there's a commitment and a legally enforceable commitment to have things happen out in those communities.
Senator Eben?
Mr. Chair, if I could just add that we could have very long testimony and discussion of this entire perfluorinated chemical issue, but because in the interest of time and because we're approaching deadlines, I wanted to just give a brief overview of the topic and also, again, publicly state my appreciation to the PCA that they came to this point at this time. I'm happy to work with the committee on this issue, other issues surrounding the perfluorinated chemical issue. For the committee's knowledge, there I have another bill up in Senator Marty's committee this evening that deals with some of the health-based values and established health risk limits for PFOA and PFOS. And we're also going to be doing some work in that bill on the perfluorinated butanoic acid, which is the compound that is was found in the communities that I represent.
Who was going to do that? Were you going to give a background on PFCs?
Mr. Chair, it wasn't my intention to do that today.
You were going to. Okay. All right.
Because I'd just like to, again, state that the legislation in Senate File 1174, it would have designated all perfluorochemicals as classified under MRLA. But at this point, I feel that as though the agency is making significant progress. They have more information on PFOA and PFOS. And, you know, on behalf of my constituents and the more than 500 people who turned up for community meetings in my district, I think that this is a step in the right direction, and I'm very look forward to working with the department as this issue proceeds and as they go to the MPCA Citizens Board to seek classification for PFOA and PFOS under MRLA.
Mr. Schirkenbach, in reference to your letter to 3M, could you describe the difference? On your second paragraph, you talk about the two ways in which PCA can formally bring this matter under MRLA. What is the difference between a request for response action and a consent order with responsible persons?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. The request for response action is kind of as laid out in statute, where if we think we're at a point where on an issue as it develops, we even need to lay out why we think something is a problem and what needs to be done about it, we would issue that. And that would be kind of a precursor to getting into a situation where we'd want to see whether the responsible party would be willing, is willing to move ahead. The way you'd move ahead, we feel, is through a consent order, consent decree, which would finally lay out exactly what will happen. What we will do here, and why we lay this out, is we are asking for a response from 3M by March 27th to find out how they want to proceed on this. And it basically, if they make a commitment to move ahead, then what we'll do is probably would not even need to go to our board in April, get the request for response action, because we believe we can go to immediately to begin to negotiate and hopefully very quickly develop a consent order decree that then would go to our agency board for approval. So we'd skip that. It's part of the formal process if we're going to get to the point where the state would move ahead, act on its own, and then go for cost recovery from a responsible party.
So the difference is, one of the differences is that the request for response action requires specific findings by the PCA, and then you move ahead with the remediation.
Right.
As opposed to a consent order where you and the responsible party simply say, we request to move forward, and there wouldn't necessarily be findings attached with that consent order, or would there?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there necessarily would be, but what would be is certainly as we came forward to our board, even for the approval of, say, a consent order or a consent decree, at that time, I think we would have to have some type of findings, even through our board item, to indicate why we think the agreement appropriately and adequately covers the pollution problems that are there. So I think no matter what, and that's why I think the commissioner, Brad Moore, was interested in using our citizens' board, given the broad public concern and interest in this, appropriately so. I think he felt this was the type of issue to use our citizens' board so there would be a forum that would allow even others to come in, but make sure that they could see that the citizens' board found the proposed action was reasonable and going to effectively deal with this type of problem.
But the consent order doesn't necessarily require the five determinations, or does it?
Actually, what we would feel is the consent order would assume that the five determinations have been made.
Okay. In the five determinations, I'm reading number four, says that there has to be determination that there was a release of a hazardous substance and or a pollutant or contaminant that poses an imminent and substantial danger to public health or the environment. And then the letter continues on to say that the PCA staff believes that sufficient evidence exists for that determination. What led to the PCA's determination that PFOAs and PFOs are hazardous substance or and or present an imminent danger?
Mr. Chairman, based upon the fact that the way it can be, one of the ways that is done is by the material being considered a hazardous waste. And basically looking at the, and with our legal consultation with the Attorney General staff, the wording is, in a hazardous waste, is it may pose a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment when improperly treated, stored, transported, or disposed of. We believe that based upon the health-based values and the studies done by the health department that we can meet that test. And so they're really coming in, so you really have... It can be then, we can feel, determine it's a hazardous substance if we feel it meets the test of being a hazardous waste. And that's what we have done. I should say, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we felt it was our position with 3M going way back that it was a hazardous substance. We didn't take the formal action because for a long period of time we felt that 3M was doing everything necessary. We still feel that. But again, given all the concern and interest and given the revised health-based value work by health department, and finally, given the fact that we're at a key point when there may be some major things that we believe need to be committed to, that we felt it was time now to make this a formal action.
Okay. Letter goes on to say that the commissioner has the authority to issue these under MRLA, but it is choosing to bring the decision on the issuance to the citizens board. Could you go through that again? I think you talked about it a little bit, but why isn't the commissioner just doing this if there is such concern on this issue and the decision has been made to proceed under MRLA formally? Why isn't the commissioner just issuing the RA or consent order?
Mr. Chairman, good question again. Two reasons. I think he believes that the board, by getting in front of the board, if there is a disagreement with 3M on this determination it has this substance, going in front of the board, given all the public interest, really gives everybody a sense to understand the rationale, the arguments, and our response on dealing with it. Number two, I think the chair, our commissioner also feels that in the future, if there is any type of dispute or appeal as far as cost recovery or anything else, by having the citizens board involved, he believes that strengthens an agency position on moving if there is any problems or issues that are raised in the future.
Thank you. On the second page, in the second full paragraph, it talks about a consent order already being in effect from previous contamination in 1985, or is that a correct assessment?
And actually, Mr. Chair, yeah, it was 3M as far as it was previous releases from the site, but at that time we did not have the information on the perfluoral chemicals. And so that's why we believe that, again, the waste was there that led to the releases, and therefore we have been somewhat moving ahead under that, but we think it's time now to clarify that and cover the new material or information we have that specifically relates to the perfluoral chemicals involved.
So what you're saying in this paragraph is that the consent order from 1985 didn't have anything to do with PFCs?
Right. At that time, we did not have the information about the presence of the PFCs. There was not even, you know, any type of testing for that type of chemical. That's the tough issue, Mr. Chairman, and I know it's hard for a lot of people to understand that in a lot of cases, the materials may be there, but we may not even be aware of the testing procedures or have information that says we should be looking for something at that point in time.
What is that consent order from 1985 regarding?
A lot of solvents and volatile organic compounds that were disposed at the site. So it was focused on a different variety of chemicals that were in the waste that had been disposed of there.
Okay. All right. Questions from the committee? I think Senator Olson had her hand up. We'll get to Senator Dibble then.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the challenge of a lot of acronyms is that if we don't follow the rule of the first time that you, when you start using it, that you have spell out the thing and then you put it in parens so you can follow it. And I have been distracting me to try to understand them while I've been trying to listen to you. And on the Attorney General's, next to the last paragraph, it had two that I didn't figure out, and then I heard you use one, the HBV. I heard you say health-based values. So that must be what HBV is. But HBV for PFBA, I can't find PFBA anywhere in any of these letters. I presume it's petrofluorocarbons, but what's BA stand for?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I shouldn't attempt to explain this myself, but I'll try. PFBA is perfluorinated butanoic acid. It's a four-chain molecule. Four-chain molecule, which is in the same class of chemicals. It's a perfluorinated chemical, similar to PFOS and PFOA, but it has a different chemical makeup than the other two. And
it wasn't spelled out so that you didn't know what that was.
Okay, sorry.
All right, thanks.
Sorry about
that.
Well,
you don't have to apologize. It's the Attorney General.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to understand the Citizens Board process a little bit better. Could you tell me who serves on that board and whether or not they have kind of the final authority or if they're advisory to the commissioner?
Actually, it's a good question, Senator Dibble, Chair. Actually, it's a 9-member citizen board, although the chair of the board is the commissioner. And so actually there's 8 citizen members on that. And they do have decision authority. The main areas that they are involved in is really related to rules, permitting, formal approvals, if it gets into something like this, RFRA, request for response action, and also for environmental review processes.
So,
as follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who are they? Maybe we could get a list from you.
We can get you a list, and I apologize. We've had some changes, and I don't have it right off the tip of my tongue right now, but we can get you the members, yes.
And, Mr. Chair, how do they find their way onto the board?
They are appointed by the governor.
Mr. Chair, are they confirmed by ourselves, by the Senate?
Yes.
So we should know who they are.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I should too. I just can't remember right now all the names. I know some of them. I just couldn't go through the full list right now.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, what?
Go ahead, Senator Dibble.
What is their process of considering this RFRA decision, or I'm sorry, MRLA decision, or whatever it is, whatever acronym? What is their process? Do they have a formalized process of having public hearings and the evidence? And
Senator Dibble, Mr. Chair, actually, the process is there's monthly board meetings. Mm-hmm. And what it usually is the process is we come in and have the staff presents a position. And usually that position has three elements. We have background discussion, provide them information on what they're dealing with. Then we usually have laying out different options on what they could be doing on it. And so that's one of the things they've always wanted is to know, don't just give us your recommendation, give us other options on what we could do. And then our final recommendation. And usually on this type of thing, as was mentioned before, we try to indicate if findings were needed to support the position. And that's often where the Attorney General staff is there advising the board. There's somebody assigned to advise the board from the Attorney General staff. Then usually the findings are made sure that they're adequate and sufficient to support the final conclusion and recommendation.
So,
Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, that sounds like that's not a public hearing with public testimony.
No, Senator Dibble, it is a public meeting. And so the meeting is there, and they take testimony on issues. So that's one of the first things. Usually the process is the staff first provides the overview, the recommendation and options, but then there is a public testimony period. So if somebody wants to come in and argue any position or provide further information they think is relevant to the issue at hand, that can be done.
Follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Does the board ever, can the Citizens Board receive, is their agenda confined only to those things that the commissioner brings to them, or do they take up items that other interest parties or members of the public bring to them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, they take up others. There's actually rules that we have for operations of the board, and in those rules are sections that relate to items, and items can come in either by a request of the chair or the commissioner to bring them forward, or any other board member can even be asked to bring it forward. And then if it's there's even in the board rules, what's covered is if somebody asks for something to be raised, there's also a process that it has to be identified that the request was made and the reasons not to.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. And then once a decision has been reached, a determination has been made, you know, whatever we call that, is that appealable to the administrative law judge process, or not, or to the courts, or I suppose anything's appealable to the courts? But is there a process established to go to the I can't remember the name of the department or agency that has the administrative law judges?
It's got an acronym for sure.
Yeah, it's like OLA.
Chair, Senator Dibble, if it's on rules, the administrative law judge will be involved because we'll have this hearing, and then the administrative judge will come back with a recommendation to the board. Mm-hmm. But the final action is actually taken by the board on that. Then if it's appealable from there, then it would be appealed to the courts.
But on this MRLA RFRA stuff?
Then it would be, the appeal would be to the courts directly. There wouldn't be an administrative law judge involved in that. That is the authority that's already there then for the commissioner to move forward and make a recommendation to the board on this type of issue.
So 3M can appeal this intent to determine under, I'm going to try and avoid the acronym, the request for response action. 3M can appeal it.
Mr. Chair.
In district court.
Yes, that's my understanding. Yes.
Okay. Is that common?
Appeals of board actions have occurred over the years. There's been several of those. It's not uncommon. It doesn't happen that frequently, but it's not uncommon. Mr. Chair, if I could, just going back to this, I apologize as far as the information. This is not an easy subject to get into, to understand. And as maybe Senator Sieben knows, that at these public meetings, it takes a long time to try to lay out and understand first what the chemicals are, why they are of concern, what's happened out in the communities, both as far as the disposal sites and the groundwater, and then what needs to be done in the future. But I guess what I'm doing is offering that if there's time and a request, we'd be more than happy to come here and help understand what is a very complex but important issue.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Chaudhry asked about this 1985 consent order at the Cottage Grove site. I see on this other letter there's a 1983 consent order at the Oakdale site. What did that involve?
That was also both, Chair, Senator Dibble. That also involved just a consent decree on that one because Oakdale site and the Chemelite site were placed on the Superfund list. Then we deal with those site by site. And so there were separate orders on each one of those sites as far as what we felt needed to be done.
And, Mr. Chair, those are different chemicals, different issues.
Yes, but they were, at the time, they were focused on different chemicals and different issues.
And what's happening under these various consent orders? Is there cleanup being undertaken to try to get that nasty business out of the ground or out of the water?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, actually, the cleanup was taken at those sites, and there was even the issue of request for delisting those sites when the PFCs became evident. So that kind of rolled over now into these new issues. So we think the others were being addressed, and what needed to be done was done. Now these raise the whole new array of issues, and that's why we're now looking at coming up with this idea of new consent decree. Again, for a long time, there just was a lot of investigation was needed even to fully understand the scope and extent of the problems so that we can even determine what are appropriate solutions.
Sieben.
Mr. Chair, and I actually have a question for Mr. Schirkenbach. I'm wondering under the 1985 decree or the 1983 decree, the consent orders, did the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency know about PFCs at those sites?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, no, we did not.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Schirkenbach, has that been determined yet, whether there were PFCs at those sites at the time?
Sure, yes. We've determined that there were PFCs as part of the waste that were.
And, Mr. Chair, was that disclosed by 3M?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, yes, that's information that we've gotten from 3M on the disposal of waste at those sites.
At that time?
Going back previously.
You look back and have discovered since that there were PFCs there, and that discovery was based on information provided by 3M.
At a later date.
Yes.
Correct. Senator Vickerman.
Well, sure. Mr. Chair, I'm just a country boy trying to figure out what all is going on here. I know we're talking about 3M, but I don't see it, so I'm supposed to imagine that 3M is really what this bill is all about. Can't we concentrate on 3M instead of going, I look at this bill statewide. As a farmer, I can see some people calling me and say, well, it's a hazardous. Well, we deal with all kinds of chemicals in my farming operation. And maybe they come under something else.
Senator,
I'm just right now not totally understanding and satisfied on what we're trying to do here. I know we're trying to clean it up. I agree with that 100%.
Sure.
But are we moving too fast to make this more of a statewide bill, or maybe Senate Consa could help me? Am I in the right track?
Senator Vickerman, at the beginning of the hearing, Senator Sieben indicated she would not be pursuing this bill. So we are, and it was based on information that was given to us by PCA just yesterday, that the department is going to pursue this route on its own without the necessity for this bill. And so we're just hearing from the department on what exactly they're going to be pursuing.
So we're not, Senator Sieben is not pursuing this Senate file today.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, under our current law, the designation of hazardous substances occurs either through at the federal level, through their law, or through the Clean Air Act. And I think that at the state waste. Level is a part of that, and it's those processes that are normally used. This was essentially naming a specific one in statute rather than allowing our normal agencies to go through the process of doing that, and that's what they have in fact done, and that's why the PCA has come forward, has sent these letters, and so it's following the procedures of the current law.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson.
Senator Olson, this is Minnesota statute as well that she is amending. So at some point,
I know.
The legislature did enact into our statute something about hazardous waste. The current law references the federal stuff. But Mr. Knopf, can you just kind of give us the... What's the complete answer to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Schirkenbach alluded to this earlier. Is you see number 3 on line 1.13 of the bill, any hazardous waste. And if you look in the definition under the same chapter for hazardous waste means ones that are named by the agency. They're either under federal law or by the agency. And as Mr. Schirkenbach pointed out, in chapter 116, which actually there's kind of 3 levels. You get back to the definition in chapter 116, and there's a clause in there where the agency basically names hazardous waste, and under B, it'll pose a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment when improperly treated, stored, transported, or disposed of, or otherwise managed. That's directly from Mr. Schirkenbach quoted that earlier. That's directly from the definition of a hazardous waste, so the agency then determines what wastes are hazardous. And by virtue of calling this, basically designating this a hazardous waste, it automatically, through, like I said, 2 definitions, gets to number 3, any hazardous waste. And so that's how it becomes a hazardous substance under this. The agency also can, and you can see that in the letters, the agency can, a pollutant or contaminant, they can use it, but they have to make a showing that it poses an imminent and substantial danger to the public health or environment for a pollutant or contaminant. But what they've chosen, the route, as I understand it, is to declare PFOA and PFOS as a hazardous waste, and that way this definition then picks them up through that method.
And I notice in our current statute we do specify what is not considered a hazardous substance as well. So we do specify to a degree. Who's next?
Mr. Vickerman. Senator
Vickerman. Mr. Schirkenbach.
Mr. Chair, if I could, though, just to get to Senator Vickerman's question, if I got it right, is, again, not to be concerned that the rest of the state is covered. Under MRLA, our state Superfund law, we've addressed 200, there's been 255 sites addressed throughout the whole state. And we've dealt with over 160. Right now we have 96 sites left. Those have come all around. And there's a variety of ways, as Mr. Knopf had indicated, that we can get in there and identify if there's hazardous waste. We can even use pollutant contaminants, others that come under, and definitions under the Clean Water Act and our water authority. So there's a variety of ways. The one thing is that MRLA, the Superfund law, is kind of reactive. It doesn't really have us create laws to manage anything, but it's a reactive thing where once problems are created, then we go in a number of ways we can show that it poses an imminent and threat to health and safety or something, and then we can respond. The one thing that it does force us to do, there are not specific cleanup standards in the state Superfund. We do it by connecting to other types of things, such as the hazardous waste definition, to determine that something needs to be responded to under the cleanup law. I hope that helped. But, I mean, we have adequate tools to cover the sites that are across the state that have similar situations. This poses a challenge because of perfluorochemicals. We're just getting more information, and that's where the health department is trying to come up with more information to understand what are the health risks that are involved with these perfluorochemicals.
Perfluorochemicals are exclusive or generally exclusive to Scotchgard and what was the other?
Teflon. Teflon is products that have had these perfluorochemicals, the 8-chain, the ones that have been persistent and bioaccumulative, where there's been a concern on what they have done and how broad they've gotten in the environment.
Is 3M the only company or one of the only companies that made Teflon? And I think it was the only one that made Scotchgard.
They, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there were other companies, DuPont, that did make some of the perfluorochemicals.
Okay. All right. How many of those, to your knowledge, I guess I don't expect you to know this answer, but if you happen to know it offhand, how many of these companies that produce products with PFCs are located in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, there are none others in greater Minnesota.
And members of the committee, that PFCs were manufactured at the Cottage Grove facility at the Chemolite plant in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. And I believe that they were also sold to DuPont. PFCs were sold to DuPont to be used in their manufacturing process in other parts of the country. And again, there's so much information to go over on both the manufacturing end of it. Also, we could spend a lot more time talking about the contamination at these three sites and how it leached into the groundwater and now is in residents' drinking water. And then, of course, there's the arguments over the health-based values and if the Department of Health are setting levels that are protective enough of human health. That, again, I was, trying to be cognizant of the committee's time, but I'm happy to spend more time on this in the future.
Any more questions for Senator Sieben or department? Does 3M want to say anything?
I don't think so.
She's not proceeding with the bill.
I guess I have a couple questions, Mr. Regev. Right.
Don't have a bill before us.
Thank you. Would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Michael Santoro, Director of Environmental Regulatory Affairs at 3M.
Has 3M had a chance to digest the correspondence from PCA from yesterday?
Mr. Chair, yes, to some degree, yes.
What is its initial reaction?
Well, Mr. Chair and committee, generally speaking, we believe that the state has the authority to list substances under MRLA. They have hazardous waste rules that are in place, and we feel that that's the appropriate place to deal with this subject. We do not believe these substances are hazardous substances, but we are willing to discuss this directly with with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and go through the formal process that has been established through the rules of the state.
Does that indicate that there's a likelihood of a consent order with regards to PFCs?
Mr. Chair and committee, we believe that some sort of formal document here or some formal instrument would be appropriate. We have had good experience with memoranda of understanding that we've developed with the agency as well as other agencies throughout the country. We don't feel that listing these affects the ability for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to recover costs, oversight costs, or monitoring costs that they incur. In fact, we do pay for oversight costs that we have over the years for these substances, and we're committed to do so into the future. Basically, just to say that we're willing to work out some formal agreement with the state of Minnesota.
But not necessarily a consent order.
I don't think we know exactly exactly what that means in terms of whether there's some other instrument that might be appropriate. So we need to discuss that with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
But the letter only talks about a request for response action or a consent order. It doesn't talk about any other type of instrument. Sounds like these are the only two choices.
We understand, but again, I think, Mr. Chair, we would like to discuss this more in detail with the agency going forward.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Centro.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, further discussion on...
There's no discussion. She didn't pursue it. We have another bill.
Well, the bill is on the agenda. It's before us. Senator Stephen has indicated she does not want to pursue it, and that is her right. So I'm just wondering if there's any other discussion on it. Senator Dibble.
So, Senator Stephen, you're telling us for the time being, you're satisfied with the agency's actions. You're going to be keeping an eye on how this process goes forward. I assume you're going to engage with the citizens board as well.
Yes. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, that is my intent. Again, we got this letter last night from the Pollution Control Agency. While I understand the company's opposition to the legislation and the process that I was pursuing in terms of, and I think this was getting at Senator Olson's question, pursuing this type of designation under Minnesota statute, I am very pleased that the Pollution Control Agency made this determination, and I am confident that they're going to go to their citizen advisory board and recommend that these two contaminants, PFOA and PFOS, be considered under MRLA. And in my opinion, and in the opinion of many people I've talked to in the community, this is a positive development.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you. Thank you, I thank you for your leadership on this on behalf of your own constituents as well as on behalf of, all of us who've been watching this, because, of course, we have similar concerns, even though this may not touch my district, when something like this occurs and there's some question about the extent and the toxicity, et cetera, it gets the attention of everyone around the state. I think, it does have statewide application in that sense. So I just ask that that to the extent you're able or your office is able to keep us informed of how this proceeds, I'd be most appreciative.
I would be happy to.
I think the biggest question is that was revealed is the appeal. Is the court appeal. There's a disagreement. We've heard that PFCs are a hazardous substance. There's not yet an agreement on whether to pursue the process that the PC has laid out. So there is a potential for an appeal to district court. District court means that there could be a trial. And after a trial, it means the further appeal before the Court of Appeals. And then after that, an appeal before the Supreme Court. So,
Mr. Chair, this...
we appreciate what the PCA is doing, that doesn't mean the issue is resolved.
No,
by
but
a long shot.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this also would have been subject to litigation, I believe, if I would have passed my legislation, too, and if it would have become law. So,
how so?
I shouldn't attempt to describe this process, I guess, but I would imagine that that it could have been pursued by the company. Maybe Mr. Knopf can help me out here, but...
If we pass a law, the only objection is whether it's unconstitutional. I don't see how that could be the case. Maybe a case could be made, but I'm not sure how.
where they referred to first.
I'm getting a nod from council. But if there's no further discussion, we're going to lay over Senate File 1174. Thank you very much, Senator Sieben.
Thank you.
And we're going to keep an eye on this issue very closely.
We're finish up 1119.
Yep. We're back to Senator Saxog's 1119.
Yep.
What was the issue?
Didn't have
copies?
In front of us.
Oh, okay.
Well, we didn't have the original bill copy. We had the subcommittee.
Oh, okay. We don't have enough copies.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chairman Scogan, you have to refresh my memory exactly where we were here. We had amended the subcommittee and passed that.
We have passed the subcommittee report. We have not adopted the A3 amendment. Is that right, okay. Mr. Knopf?
So we had passed out the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair, and it is an attempt to explain it. It was briefly a change land inserting bordering public water, and that's, as we explained, that the fact it was a former Boy Scout camp.
Ms. Lewis,
anyway.
So,
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A3 amendment.
A3 amendment is before us, committee. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those say no. And it's your bill, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1119 is the DNR Omnibus Lands Bill. With me today is Kathy Lewis and Paul Posier. They're from DNR Lands and Minerals, and they'd like to go over the bill. I think Kathy will note there's some rather important portions in there, some of them having to do with the steel mill and land exchange that's happening up in on the Iron Range. And so I'm going to turn it this time over to Kathy Lewis.
Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kathy Lewis with the DNR. I'm going to work from the Senate file as introduced, and then I could go to the subcommittee report and cover those sections if that's appropriate.
We do have to be done by 2:45.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move quickly. Most of the bill is land sale provisions, and we can go over those quickly. The first three sections of the bill are a bit more substantive, though mostly technical in nature. Section 1 of the bill concerns the process that the DNR uses to value land for land acquisitions, and the appraisal process is becoming more costly and time-consuming, and we were authorized by the legislature a few years ago to do what's basically an abbreviated appraisal process. We're asking for authorization to do that for a higher value of land. Under 84.02.72 Subdivision 4, which you don't see because it's not being amended, the landowner has to agree to the use of this process. Section 2 of the bill is resolving a statutory interpretation between two laws. Under the Landowner Bill of Rights, which the DNR must use for working with landowners, willing sellers to buy their land, we are required to provide them, and we do provide them, the appraised value of the land. However, we identified last year that the Data Practices Act provides that appraisal data is protected non-public data until the parties actually enter into an agreement. And protected non-public data means you cannot even provide it to the subject of the data. And so that means we could not, under the Data Practices Act, provide them the appraised value. We just want to clarify that the specific law controls here for the DNR, and that when we're working on with willing sellers, we can continue to provide them the appraised value as we negotiate with them to buy the property. Section 3 of the bill is our minerals issue that concerns the severed mineral interest law, and this requires parties to own minerals separate from the surface interest to file a statement in the county recorder's office and pay an annual tax. When the mineral ownership interest is transferred, a new statement must be filed. We've had a court case this last year, went to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. They said there's an ambiguity in the statute that probably arises due to amendments over the years. And they said, well, while this requirement to file a statement when ownership transfers is correct, the forfeiture of that for failure to file is a question for resolving the statutory interpretation. We said, instead of continuing to fight this in the court, we're going to bring it to the legislature and let the legislature resolve the ambiguity and say, continue the enforcement of the law through forfeiture for failure to file the statement. Sections 4 and 5 of the bill concern minor state park boundary changes. For the Flandreau State Park, there was unintentional trespass, and we're adding 508 square feet and taking out 391 square feet, and they will subsequently enter into a land exchange. But currently under state law, you cannot exchange land out of a state park unless it's school trust fund land. So what we're doing here is changing the park boundaries, and then we'll subsequently do a land exchange. For Whitewater State Park, we're adding 5.78 acres. This is part of our larger acquisition within the park that we're acquiring from one landowner. They want to sell us what they have, and we would use this additional 5.78 acres for a DNR maintenance access route.
Ms. Lewis, question from Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lewis, who was trespassing by Flandreau Park? Was the park trespassing on a private land, or was a private landowner trespassing on the park land?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, it was the adjoining owner trespassing onto state park land.
Follow-up? We heard it in the subcommittee on lands.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I was just curious what it was.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, the next 23 sections of the bill concern the sale of DNR-administered lands. So these are lands, state-owned lands the DNR administers. In most cases, they're small parcels. They're isolated in the sense they have no adjoining state land. We're bringing them to the legislature for a variety of reasons. In a lot of the cases, it's because they border water. In a few cases, we're proposing transfers to local units of government so that they can better manage the land for public purposes. And there's a few unintentional trespass situations that we are also addressing. In total, the bill authorizes a public sale of 207 acres, the transfer or direct sale to government entities of 114 acres, and the direct private sale of 47 acres. Mr. Chair, if you want me to go through the 23 sections in detail, I can, or I can then proceed to the subcommittee report.
I would prefer that you proceed to the subcommittee report after Senator Ingebrigtsen asked his question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 12 and 13, talking about Kitson County. I might have a question with regards to line number 13-7 on page 13 as well as 13-19. I think it's supposed to be Lake Bronson all the way through there. The village of Lake Bronson, is that correct? Or am I, as well as on line 13-30. Well, they are actually identified on line 13-30 as Lake Bronson as well as 19. Excuse me, 19 is not, and 7 is not.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the legal description is derived from a plat, so it's the park addition to Bronson, and we can check that, but that we did work with the deed when we were preparing it, but these parcels are within the city of Lake Bronson.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up?
I'm from there, so I know that. The town's name is Lake Bronson. That's the only thing that caught my eye here.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Bronson is what it's actually called and it's referred to here. I just thought maybe that was a typo there on line 7.
Ms. Lewis,
Mr.
Chair, the department check on that? Or?
Yeah.
We will certainly check on that to make sure we didn't get a typo in here.
So,
Mr. Chair. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I go to page 16. Just a curious question.
Page 16.
On the top of 1611, it states the sale would be to the adjoining landowner and resolve an unintentional trespass if somebody built a garage and a house. They must live in a different part of the world than I live in because you get a permit from the county if you're going to build a house or a garage. How in the world can you go into state land and not know that it's not Department of Natural Resources land unless it changed hands
after that? I'm just curious, because I know in some places, if you put a building or a garage or a boathouse on state land, they'll just politely tell you to move it, or we'll move it for you. I'm just curious. Can you tell me what all went on there? Maybe it was way back in history someplace.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, this is a parcel of land in Lake County where the landowner, in most cases, there have been one or two transfers of ownership since the original construction occurred, and it does happen on occasion. We work with landowners to try to work out different solutions, land exchanges. Land sales is one of the options. We obviously don't encourage people building property on state land, but it does happen. There's one provision here where we actually made a mistake, too. So we try to watch it very carefully, and we identify whether it would make sense for natural resources purposes to allow the direct sale to resolve it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
just a follow-up.
I would hope that you would pay very close attention to that so something like this doesn't happen in the future. This land is selling all around the lake, just all around.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it was back to Senator Ingebrigtsen's point. There is, you did pick up, there is one place that does refer to Lake Bronson.
Yeah.
And they're all the same block four of that particular plat. If there's some technicality in what was copied from that it was written, would you need to have it that way in the statute if it was an error there? Or could it be corrected to include the accurate name of the town?
Mr. Chair, members, what we will do is pull the deed from which it was, which this description was derived, see if we've made a typo, if it's actually in the deed. And then you can make some changes from the deed, but it starts raising questions in the title when people check the title. So you kind of make an educated legal call on whether you should make a change from what was written last time. So we'll have to review it and decide which way it works. Thanks.
Other questions? Back to you then, Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, we are now moving on to the subcommittee report. And these were bills that were added in subcommittee brought by other members. The first one is titled, it's Section 21, Exchange of Tax Forfeited Private Sale, Itasca County. This is part of the Minnesota Steel Industries project up on the range, and they have entered into land exchange, which involves Blandon and Itasca County. So Blandon and Itasca County are exchanging land, and so it's tax forfeited land for Blandon-owned land. And then subsequently, through legislation adopted last year, the Itasca County can enter into a direct sale of that land to Minnesota Steel Industries for their plant and mine site. What the proposal that's brought here is that the subsequent sale of the property to Minnesota Steel Industries, in this case, would be exempt from the 3% real estate assurance fee. And the reason that I understand is that the property in the land exchange was subject to title review by the Itasca County Attorney's Office and the Attorney General's Office. And what happens in the land exchange is what was Blandon land becomes tax forfeited land. And so that land that is going to be sold never was subject to the tax forfeiture proceedings, and there should not be any title issues regarding tax forfeiture errors being raised regarding those lands, and that's the reason they're being asked to be accepted from the tax real estate assurance fund. The lines 2.10 through 2.14 also tie into the same transaction, and the county is authorized to issue leases for 10-year terms for certain purposes, for 15 years for tailings basins and stockpiles, and the easements are issued for the term as the county board desires. Minnesota Steel, as they're working with their financing company, says their financing company requires a 20-year term, and so what they are doing here is getting authorization for the county board to issue a 20-year term to meet the financing requirements. Section 30 is a proposal that was brought forth by Lake County, and this is a parcel of land that the Lake County tax forfeited land. The Lake County has been working with a Boy Scout group, and what they're going to be doing is actually, in effect, there's a piece of land that the Boy Scouts are currently using that they are going to let go tax forfeited, and this piece would be sold to the Boy Scouts for use of their camp, and it aids the county in a bridge issue, a crossings for two waters. Section 31 of the bill concerns property in Lake County that they have acquired with from it was originally owned by the Wolfwood Corporation. It's gone through trust, the Nature Conservancy. The DNR is actually in the process of going to be acquiring conservation easement on this property. Lake County has purchased it in fee, and they have identified the means by which to pay for the acquisition is through this process of taking the net proceeds from other land sales. And they have also identified that they are naming it in memory of their land commissioner that passed away just a few months ago.
Mr. Chair, it was the county commissioner, but he's well known, and he did a lot of great conservation work up there.
Claire Nelson. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, that is the summary of the subcommittee report.
Just for my knowledge, does the DNR go and look at all these parcels, or do they work off maps and phone calls, or how do they do this, Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, for the DNR parcels, we work through our regional staff, so our area staff have seen the different DNR parcels, identified it through a process. We've made some extra effort in the last year to identify small parcels or isolated parcels that we're not actively managing. For the tax forfeited parcels, that the counties bring those forth. And so in some cases, we may have visited the sites. In other cases, we will look at maps and information on file to see if we have any concerns about them.
Questions for Ms. Lewis? Senator Saxon, would you like to move the bill?
Senator Olson, excuse me, Sarah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask Senator Saxon, are you going to move to put the other two bills that we acted on earlier into this bill?
Yes, thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Chair, what I was going to do is I was going to move to add the contents of, or first of all, to take Senate File 1401 and 1156 off the table and add those contents to Senate File 1119.
To the motion. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Frederickson.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, as I was reading page 2, the lines 19 to 26, there's some very, very clumsy phrasing in there.
Of the report?
Of the bill, the original bill. So, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm going to move to amend on line 20, page 2, line 20. Delete shall allow the owner along and insert the owner shall be allowed to accompany the appraiser. It's no substantive change, just better phrasing, I think. And on line 22, delete go along on and insert to accompany the appraiser on the.
Go along on. Oh.
Slangy.
Correct.
To the amendment, the oral amendment presented by Senator Frederickson. Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
So then, Mr. Chair, this bill needs to go to the judiciary, so I would move that Senate File 1119 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, on page 3 of the bill, line 12, I move to delete the word such and insert the word the.
To the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Back to the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Senator, for
your
time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis.
I didn't get the first.
This committee is adjourned.